From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a series of scores, and they are almost shockingly bad for the city of Rochester. The numbers offer a look at how Rochester is doing when it comes to a concept known as inclusive recovery. That means the city doesn't just see improvements to its economy over time, to its workforce, its home ownership, its average income. Inclusive recovery means that everyone shares in the benefits. A city that struggles in this regard is a city that sees the benefits shuttled to a small group of people, usually people who already have higher income, often white. And when this happens, inequality gaps get wider. I watched a presentation this weekend about Rochester that was, in one sense, deeply discouraging. But as the presenter noted, there is massive room for growth here. Let me give you some specifics about just how rough things have been in Rochester. This is out of 274 American cities, with one being the best possible score. Here's how Rochester fared on various categories in recent years. 257th in the poverty gap, 248th in high school dropout rate, 246th in racial segregation, 236th in economic inclusion, 226th in rent burden, 223rd in something called the Racial Inclusion Index, 172nd in income segregation. By so many measures, Rochester has been faring poorly. Even when some indicators improve, they almost never improve in ways that benefit the city equally. And you might assume that this is common in cities across the country. It often is. But in Rochester, just about every measure is extreme or heightened. And for many decades, the leadership in this country, I mean, we're talking communities across the country, this is no secret. For decades in this country, leadership was mostly white, mostly male. And the people who benefited from government policy were often white, often male. Now the local leadership is not mostly white. The results have not changed much. In some ways, things have gotten worse. So let's focus on the opportunity that's in front of us right now. The Urban Institute studied four American cities that did a comparatively strong job at creating, well, at least new ideas that might lead to inclusive recovery. And they compiled a list of strategies that cities like Rochester can use to finally see some success. They've even created maps showing where Rochester is struggling most with housing instability, as well as where Rochester has lost jobs specifically due to the pandemic. Our guests this hour have some ideas on how Rochester can finally end up on the good end of the lists of economic measures. And this is timely. The new $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan has money for counties, municipalities. This is a big open door on how to spend it. And the annual report card from Act Rochester, the work that these organizations do in the community, is a kind of watchdog into how this is going, whether it's working. So let's talk about where we go next with this. Our guests include the executive director of Act Rochester, Ann Johnson, back with us. Hi, Ann. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Wonderful introduction. Thank you.
Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Community Foundation. Hi, Simeon.
Good to be with you, Evan.
And Tina Stacy is a Principal Research Associate for the Urban Institute, and much of what I brought into the introduction came from her and her colleagues' research, and it's great to have you, Tina. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me start by asking Ann and Simeon to give us a little bit of an outline of what's happening this week, and then we're going to work through some of what the numbers tell us and some of where we might go next here. And what's happening this week?
So this week, ACT Rochester will host its 9th annual report card event. But this year, instead of being live at the Rochester Museum and Science Center, we're going to be doing a webinar, which means there's a lot of capacity. We have over 250 people registered, but we have room for up to 500. So we wanted to be sure. We talked about it a little bit on your show today. Usually, in our report card events, we spend quite a bit of time going through the 10 report cards, the region and the 9 counties. This year, we decided it's more important, based on everything you just said about opportunities coming our way, to look at inclusive recovery. It's made up of, as you mentioned, the numbers, indices that we need to take a look at for our community. And so it's a nice marriage with ACT Rochester's focus on data, but it's a different way of us doing it this year, since we're going to keep it to an hour and 15 minutes and do it by webinar.
Okay. Simeon, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I will. Again, Evan, thanks for having us on. And as you know, over the course of the last year, we've had a chance to come and share some of the things that the Community Foundation had been engaged in whether it was on providing educational resources and trying to solve for some of the issues around digital equity, co-leading the Communities Crisis Fund, and trying to respond to some of the real challenges of the pandemic. And now as we start to peer at the light at the hopeful end of the tunnel, we recognize that it's the appropriate time to really start talking about recovery and how we rebuild. And so in order to do that, in addition to the event tomorrow with ECK Rochester, today, in a little less than 2 hours, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, U.S. Senator Gillibrand, is going to be joining us. And folks that are interested, just go to recf.org/webinars, and you'll see the link there. And we'd love to have you join us for both days. We're talking about inclusive recovery in the American Rescue Plan today. And then tomorrow, we're talking about inclusive recovery with folks from the city, the county, and the school district, along with our colleagues at Urban Institute and Brookings Institute.
Well, before we talk to Tina about some of what the Urban Institute has compiled in terms of where Rochester is and maybe the opportunity in front of us, can I just ask both of you? I mean, Simeon, I watched that presentation and I admit I kind of thought, this is so deflating. You know, I mean, I want to look ahead and say, all right, doors open here. Things are going to change. I also know that, you know, just take the RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. I know that things don't change in 6 months or a year or even sometimes 5 years. But, boy, those numbers are really rough, and it's hard to digest sometimes. What did you think?
So for me...
go ahead, Ann. Why don't we do Ann and then Simeon.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Ann. Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. So for me, Evan, you know, we've talked since ACT launched 11 years ago about ACT standing for Achieving Community Targets. And as a community, we've had a hard time coming together to do that. We have individually done a lot better job in measuring our outcomes. Our, you just mentioned RMAPI, but many of our collective impact groups are still struggling with how to measure their impact. And, you know, as it would be in Friday's RBJ, Bob Duffy said, listen, this is no longer about silos and turfs. It's about building together toward results. The challenge I think we have is there's not a common set of results that we're aiming at. And what is provided through the inclusive recovery are not only results that will help us increase the economy, but also look at doing that inclusively. And I think it could be a roadmap, one that is overdue for our community to look at how we want to align all these different efforts that are working to drive outputs, but more importantly, outcomes. I'll give it to Simeon.
Yeah, go ahead, Simeon.
Yeah, so James Baldwin said that not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And I think that's certainly the spirit of this effort. This community has really tried to rally, and I think that, you know, a tip of the cap to many of the folks that have really tried to kind of stand on the wall to deal with the deconcentration and reduction of poverty, to close some of our opportunity and achievement gaps in education, primarily through Rock the Future, the efforts of connected communities to revitalize the neighborhoods of Emma and Beechwood, Rock 2025's efforts to think about the overall economic health of our community, and even now really starting to focus through the Climate Solutions Accelerator on climate change and its impact here in Rochester and collective ways that we can deal with those challenges. So there's certainly the will in the community. The question, though, is the what. And I think that we're presented with this very unique opportunity because we often find ourselves as community problem solvers kind of shaking our hands at the proverbial moon and kind of, you know, trying to figure out what we can do and what we can do it with. We have massive resources that are coming to this community. We know that the city of Rochester is slated to receive somewhere in the neighborhood of about $205, $206 million. The school district, its allocation is $196 million, $39 million of which is really to think about closing these gaps that have just widened over the course of the past year, the county getting $140 million. But what we want to do is have a conversation that's more informed than just, hey, there's a lot of money coming, and everybody kind of organize around the trough. The idea here is, what can we do differently, right? What can we do in ways that correct for some of the historic challenges that we have seen in this community as a result of primarily racial exclusion? If we turn our eyes backwards and we think about the 1930s in this country, Evan, what we know is that there was a massive distribution of resources through the New Deal that changed the direction of America. Just to put things into perspective, the New Deal, inflation adjusted for today, was about $800 billion. And we know that just the American Rescue Plan was $1.9 trillion. And we know that the $1.9 trillion is possibly going to be followed up with the American Families Plan and Jobs Plan, which represents up to $3 to $4 trillion more dollars. So this is a chance to fundamentally change the trajectory of the country. The question is, do we do it in ways that were racially exclusive, intentionally or unintentionally, as we did back in the 30s, and as that echo effect has continued to today, or do we do something different? And my hope is, and what we certainly want to try to champion for Rochester, is that we do it in a way that allows for people that have been historically excluded to end up with real dollars in their hands in ways that help to stimulate the community and create economic parity.
Well, and this is where I think, let me ask Tina Stacy, a principal research associate for the Urban Institute. This is where I think the skeptics need to see the data. And some of what I took that was hopeful out of your presentation, and maybe you can elaborate on this, is that cities, communities that are pursuing a more inclusive recovery intentionally are, generally speaking, they've seen some results, whether it's Fresno, California, Alexandria, Virginia, Minneapolis, Evanston, Illinois. If you are intentional about this, you can start to improve these metrics that seem sort of fixed forever. I mean, is that fair to say, Tina?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we know that it needs to be intentional. There have been cases where cities have improved on inclusion through unintentional efforts as well. We see that just through changes in the economy. But really, most of the time, when a city intentionally tries to center equity in all of their decisions, then you see improvements. And we saw really great examples of that, like you said, from cities across the country.
Is there one that stands out above others in terms of a success story to you?
Well, you know, we studied in depth four cities that had inclusively recovered from distress over time. We had, you know, measured economic growth and recovery and then inclusion over time. And we found ones that had improved on both during a recovery period. And some examples, very specific, tangible examples I liked were in Louisville, Kentucky, when they consolidated the city and county, they had a third party, the university's geography department, redraw their district boundaries so that the representation of the government would better represent the population of the region, of the city. And so that was a very tangible way in which they were able to increase equity and representation, which then led to much more equitable policymaking down the line. So I love that example. And one other great one that I think is a great example of how you can improve both your economy and inclusion at the same time is Lowell, Massachusetts. When they had a big influx of Cambodian refugees, I think it was in the 90s, they really supported this group and they literally celebrated them by helping to create a Southeast Asian water festival, which now draws tens of thousands of tourists every year. So this has helped both economic growth and with inclusion for this population.
On the subject of Louisville, Tina, before I ask Simeon and Ann about that, just make sure I understand the representation aspect of it. What exactly was done in Louisville?
They redrew. So when the city consolidated with the county, they had to redraw their district boundary lines for city council members. Uh-huh. And so they had the geography department redraw them so that there were majority African-American districts so that they would have better representation in the city government, a more representative in terms of race of the overall population.
Sure. And so, you know, Simeon, for example, I you know, when you hear about representation matters, that is a conversation that is sort of spilled into whether black students see black teachers or whether there are officers, and so it goes in a lot of directions. And sometimes the pushback I hear is, well, you don't need, you know, it's a good goal to have, but absent that, you can still, make sure that whoever is making the policy, making the rules, teaching the class, running the government is responsive to all needs. And the story of Louisville seems to be, to me, a nice little data point that says you can be well-intentioned and still fall short here, and representation still really does matter here. I mean, how do you see that, Simeon?
Well, yeah, and so if we take the example of Louisville, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is the outcome that we're seeking to achieve, right? So what's the goal here? And if the goal is, you know, to be able to sleep at night and feel better, then, yeah, there's some, you know, kind of window dressing things that we might do. But if our goal is really to see the kind of transformative change that sets our community up for vibrant growth, then that means that we've got to kind of like do the work, right? And so in the case of Louisville, I see a question about power, frankly, and who has power and what communities get to exercise power. And in that case, by making sure that we had shared power, that you started to see outcomes that were commensurate with greater levels of participation and ultimately making sure that folks were not being kind of left behind, whole communities, whole sections of the communities were being left behind. And isn't that a story that we know well here? Our challenge is present in ways that are a little bit different. But fundamentally, the question that we have to ask, again, what is the goal that we're trying to achieve? Part of that goal has to beg us to ask, when we look at the private sector, the public sector, the nonprofit sector, and we see the same trend over and over and over again, and that trend is a lot of bias. We see a lot of trends that err towards people that have been historically excluded, not actively able to participate in the economy. That means that we've got something to do. We've got a what that we can start to focus on. I would argue, and this is just, you know, my take on it, that fundamentally the question that we have to ask is, how do we get a share of the dollars that are coming into this community through this legislation into the hands of people that have been historically excluded? And I don't mean, Evan, more programs for people that have been historically excluded. I mean actual dollars, like the real dollars into the hands of folks that have been on the economic margins. So if we're going to start programs, let's hire folks from the community to work in those programs. If we're going to invest in entrepreneurship, let's make sure that the entrepreneurs are people that are coming from communities that have historically been disinvested. The opportunity to do that is not just a nice thing to do, right? It's not just the right thing to do, although I tend to think that it is. It's also the very practical thing to do, because our budgets, whether it's the county budget that shows 76% of dollars being invested in the remediation to inequity, like, for example, 76% going towards social services, public safety and criminal justice and health, right? If you want lower taxes and we want economic growth, guess what? Let's try equity. So that's what we're kind of pitching here, is that we have this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's been 100 years since we've seen this kind of distribution of resources given these circumstances. Let's not mess this one up. Let's get this one right.
Well, and let me just follow up with you on a phrase that you used. Everything you just described is an example of doing the work. And I mean the actual work. And I don't mean to sort of rant a little bit here, but, you know, I saw over the weekend Robin DiAngelo has a new book coming out, and not to be cynical, but I'm sure every organization everywhere will, or many will require it and teach it. And I'm sure you'll hear a lot of people say, I'm doing the work. I'm reading the book. No, you're doing the reading. I mean, the work is the work. And that's one of the things that, like, is when you can have a million people do the reading, but if they are not doing the actual work, if they are not changing actual policy, if they are not doing the kind of not just program creation you said, but moving where, you know, the advantage and the money is, you've not done the work. And I guess I just appreciate you using the phrase in the context of actual work, which is hard. And I forgive me for my Monday rant. It's over, Simeon.
So Evan,
go ahead, Ann. Yes, yeah, so somebody save me.
So Evan, when we go back to look at the skepticism, you know, people have been asking since ACT Rochester and the foundation started reporting on poverty and race. Well, this is the city. Why do we need to do something in the county or the region? I want to take us back to some of the conclusions that came out of the hard facts update that we talked to you about last August, and just put things in perspective about what benefit we can have if we do the work, especially the way Simeon just described. So if people of color in our region had the same poverty rate as white people in our region, we would have nearly 50,000 fewer people in poverty. That's the population of the town of Irondequoit. Now, if we look at it a different way, if people of color here had the same poverty rate as the people of color nationwide, and as the report shows, we're far below that for our people of color. If they just had the same poverty rate, there would be nearly 22,000 less people in poverty. That's nearly half the population of the town of Webster. Now, what's the bonus, Evan? Well, the bonus is you've got lower costs, you've got higher local tax revenues, you're broadening inclusion, and you're morally doing the right thing. But you're targeting and people who are hiring and people who have the ability to do what Simeon just talked about as this opportunity comes right to us. We can have an impact.
Yeah, and who do you see as the chief decision makers? I mean, when listeners hear that there's a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that the Biden administration has helped usher through, and that communities like ours are getting a lot of money, mm-hmm. as Simeon says, maybe sort of a once-in-a-generation opportunity to get this kind of resource infusion and to do something with it, tangible dollars. Who's most in charge here, and who should be in charge, Ann?
So I think, first of all, it could be everybody, because a lot of our professional people of color have left Rochester. They've gone to Charlotte. They've gone to Atlanta. I mean, people who know folks who want to come back, they can let them know that Rochester's taking on a new flow, especially moms who want to be with their grandkids, you know. And so there's just that step. But then if you look at people who are hiring, all of our job training organizations and aligning and helping with that pipeline that I believe the chamber is taking the lead on for ROC 2020 of helping people be matched in the right jobs. I mean, there's another whole place. But as an individual organization, you should look at your demographic makeup. Who do you have in leadership? Who do you have at what different levels of the organization? And as you hire, you know, kind of tired of we can't find the right people of color for the jobs. You've got to build pools of potential people to hire so that you at least get to start to know them, and then in your networks can refer them to other people who are hiring. This isn't rocket science. This is just about more inclusively and broadly networking and tracking ourselves to make sure we're doing our part.
Simeon, you want to add to that? Who makes the decisions on this?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, Evan. We saw back in 2009 a major opportunity. We were coming out of the Great Recession, and the Obama administration set up the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, the ARRA. Folks that are listening might recall that language about shovel-ready projects. Of that legislation, about $800 billion worth of legislation appropriations, the country actually only realized about $100 billion of actual infrastructure and transportation investment because many folks didn't have those shovel-ready projects. Think about if we had a shovel-ready project 10 years ago that was organized around making sure that folks had access to the Internet in Rochester. Think about what that would have meant for digital equity. Think about what that would have meant in this crisis when we had so many young folks that couldn't connect, that couldn't even do their basic schoolwork, seniors that Ann mentioned, those grandkids, not only couldn't talk to the grandkids, but also couldn't make medical appointments, that folks that were looking for work and are getting ready to restart the process of looking for work. If we had made those investments then, how life could have been different. Let's not make that mistake again. This bill has all kinds of funds in it. There's dollars for small businesses. There's dollars for arts and cultural organizations to reopen. There's dollars for SBA lending. There's money for rental assistance and making sure that folks get water bills. There's funds in this bill to make sure that folks do get access to the internet. But it only works if people actually know about it. And so we've got to make sure that folks in our community, and that's part of what our efforts are, you ask who the decision maker is. In the past, it's frankly been a lot of smaller groups and concentric circles that have been the locus for decision making in Rochester. Hey, why don't we try something different, right? Let's try making this transparent and open and broad-based and making sure that the community is expressing its sentiment. And we believe that that's a different mode of decision making. Got some great experience with our friends at Urban Institute who have tried some of these practices. We want to see if we can't do that here in Rochester.
Talking to Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Community Foundation, and Ann Johnson, Executive Director of ACT Rochester. Tina Stacy also with us, a Principal Research Associate for the Urban Institute, which has done such interesting and important work helping contextualize how cities like Rochester are faring based on a lot of different data metrics here. And as I mentioned earlier in the hour, it was discouraging for me in a sense, but it's also a very hopeful moment. Hopeful because the Urban Institute has given us this information and this data and this context, and the Rochester Area Community Foundation, ACT Rochester, are really kind of convening these kinds of discussions before any money gets spent, before the decisions are made, especially with this recovery money about to be in our community, and a question of how do you move forward in a way that doesn't just benefit the few. Let's take this only break, and we're right back with them next. Coming up in our second hour, would you go out to a live show? Would you go to a play in an indoor theater? Would you go to a comedy show? Indoor entertainment venues have been struggling, waiting from New York State for updated guidelines. They finally have some, and it's a question of what comes next here. What's the capacity limits? What's safe? What feels right? What would you do? Owners and operators of many venues join us next hour to discuss it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tina Stacy from the Urban Institute. As I look down this list of metrics on how Rochester is faring vis-a-vis other American cities, out of 274 American cities, Rochester is ranked in recent years, as the Urban Institute mentions, 257th in the poverty gap, 248th in high school dropout rate, 246th in racial segregation, 236th in economic inclusion, 226th in rent burden. I mean, there's more. And I wanted to ask you if there are any of these metrics that sort of stand out as, I mean, they're all important, but more important than others, or more malleable, more fixable, more addressable in a short-term fashion than others?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that there's any really individual one. They're all so interrelated. And I mean, thinking about what you all have been saying about, you know, we're at a period where there's a lot of talk, right? There's a lot of talk about equity and inclusion, and people are really paying attention to it right now. What we really need to do is be able to turn that talk into action. And I mean, a period of recovery like this really is a perfect opportunity to do just that. I know we've said that some of these numbers can be a little bit disheartening, but really, you know, you take it in pieces. And rather than trying to think of one big policy or program or one big investment that's going to solve all of these or solve one, it's at centering equity in every small decision that's made. So there's not really one particular metric. They're all related, right? We know that decades, if not centuries, of racist policymaking in the housing market have led to a lot of the segregation that you're seeing. But people are finally starting to understand that history, think about it, and think about the ways that we might be able to reverse it. So I really think, you know, we should think about all of these metrics together, combined, think about how the education gaps, you know, are related to housing gaps and are related to job gaps and poverty. You know, if you can't afford to live in a good opportunity neighborhood near good jobs, then you're not going to be able to hit those other metrics. So just thinking about how to center equity in all of these decisions, I think, will help to move all of the metrics up.
The Urban Institute in Tina's recent presentation highlighted, for example, Evanston, Illinois, and listeners might have heard from NPR some of the reporting about what they're doing. I want to read some of what NPR reported out of Evanston, and then I think this is an example of what happens when, you know, I as I've been sort of like really kind of harping on in recent days. The reading is the reading and the work is the work. I mean, you can do some reading. Don't say it's doing the work, it's doing the reading. The work is the work. And maybe the reading sets you up to do the work. Or maybe the reading makes you decide you don't want to do certain things, or you do. But what's happening in Evanston is fascinating. This is from NPR. Quote, the city of Evanston, Illinois, will make reparations available to eligible black residents for what it describes as harm caused by discriminatory housing policies and practices and inaction on the city's part. The program is believed to be the first of its kind in the United States and is seen by advocates as a potential national model. Evanston City Council voted 8-1 to approve the local reparations restorative housing program, an official confirmed to NPR over email. It will grant qualifying households up to $25,000 for down payments or home repairs, and is the first initiative of a city reparations fund that was established in 2019. So that's NPR reporting on how Evanston viewed the way to get started with a word that I don't... Ann Johnson, I bet you 5-10 years ago, reparations was a word that was instantly dismissed by most white Americans of any political background.
Oh, I would absolutely agree.
And
with
I think
you.
That's starting to change.
I think it would give you heart palpitations of, oh my gosh, I don't want to discuss this. But you know what, Evan, when you look at what you just described, you know, the $25,000 for down payments or repairs. You know, if we look at, because you got to take this to our community, if we look at the 13 indicators that make up this whole set of indices, you know, when I look at vacant properties or the vacancy rate, which I see, you know, we have a terrible shortage right now in housing, you know, anywhere in our community, but especially in the city. So when we look at our vacant rates, what are the actions the people who can take action and make decisions are going to make where the vacancy rates allow for more housing to be available if, in fact, we were to give money for a down payment? You know, so again, we need to take the opportunities and align them and make sure they're relevant for our particular community because, you know, making repairs is wonderful. But if you really want to impact the other one is the rent burden. You want to impact your rent burden because you're paying so much, so you want to move to a house because your equity, building wealth, and all. It's just not available right now in the sweet spot of people starting out with new houses. So that's what I've kind of looked at is what are the indicators that are driving this? You know, how is ACT looking at them, or even are we, so that we can help put our community in a position of pushing the people who have the authority and the ability and the accountability to do with the money that's coming in the right things.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And let me, as I kick it over to Simeon Bannister, let me also just sort of clarify, because I want to be as careful as I can in talking about an issue like this. I do not mean to imply that all black Americans favor reparations. I mean, polls indicate that you know, the most recent polling I found indicate that a majority do, but it's, you know, I mean, there are literally probably millions of people who don't. And I don't mean to imply that 5-10 years ago, all white Americans would oppose it. And now, well, if you're a certain political stripe, you're for it. I mean, I understand there's a lot of nuance here. What I'm trying to, I think, describe is that starting with things like Ta-Nehisi Coates's The Case for Reparations from 2015, among many other sort of public intellectuals writing about this issue, they have, I think, allowed people to see just the cost of decades and decades and decades of economic dispossession, theft, not just slavery, but the reality of what has happened to so many black families over the years. And that's why on this program recently, Malik Evans was talking about the fact that you can ask municipalities to look at this, but you know, most of the time when you talk reparations, you're talking about it from a national level, because there have been studies indicating that to do this equitably, you need something like $14 trillion. I mean, it's a huge number, but it is a number that they've tried to kind of pin down and study and come close to figuring out just how much economic harm has been done. So Simeon, when you know, sort of think about the way the public view of this issue has moved, and you see Evanston, Illinois, and you see what the Urban Institute is saying about, you know, these kind of efforts. Does that open the door on this particular issue in Rochester to you, or are you looking at other things besides some form of reparations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a broad conversation. That said, you know, what it signals to me in terms of the changing dynamics of that conversation, the conversation about reparations, is that progress is possible, right? And so there would, you know, I have conversations with folks from a lot of different political stripes. I find myself enjoying those conversations because sometimes there are folks that say, hey, listen, nothing can change in this country, right? Everything is just the same as it's always been. But we have to acknowledge that there has been some progress. The fact that we can have on the radio open discourse about solving for all of these past injustices, the trauma, the rape, the murder, the theft, the dispossession, the exclusion, right? Those are important conversations for us to have. And as you said, it's time for us to kind of like move from just talking about it to now taking some action. And I think that's the exciting moment that we're in now. I know that there are a lot of people that are doing great work, and I don't want anybody to walk away from this program thinking that there's any down talk about the great efforts that are going on and that are underway in this community. We know that we're always trying to perfect and get better and improve, but there's some great things that are happening here in Rochester, so let's just start with that. That being said, it's also the case that it often feels like we're nibbling at the edges, right? It feels like, you know, things are changing at the margins, but that the root of this thing, the core of it, doesn't seem to be able to shift. And that's why we have to be attendant to our actual history, as I've heard you say, Evan. There are things that have actually happened in this community and in this country. So we don't have to try to do problem solving in the abstract. We can look back at what actually happened here and say, what are the breadcrumbs, right? What are the clues for what we need to do today to resolve those issues? I'm not trying to solve an abstract poverty problem here in Rochester. I'm trying to solve the one that actually emerged in the 1960s as people started to move into this community, people of color started to move into this community, as we started to see the decline of our corporate infrastructure, as we saw the initial exclusion and then the calcification of poverty amongst certain populations. I'm not solving an abstract problem of poverty, right? We've got to be attentive to the one here. And that's the thing that's exciting about this moment, is pulling together the heads of folks that are leading for collective impact and really helping to operationalize our collectives in a way that give us a chance at making sure that these dollars come into the community. Evan, this is about actionable work, right? We're not talking, again, in the abstract. These are real dollars that are coming into this community if we claim them and make them work on behalf of people that have been excluded. And as is, you'll always hear me say, that is for the benefit of those that have been excluded, absolutely no doubt, but it's also for all of our benefit because it makes for a much more vibrant community that allows us to realize our promise.
Oh, boy, I mean, that's why I keep thinking about Heather McGee's book, The Sum of Us, and listeners, that is just one that's going to be on, not only on my bookshelf as like an aspirational book that I just want people to notice, but that's going to be a book I keep going back to for exactly the reasons that Simeon just described. It's really important. Derek in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Derek.
Well, no, this isn't Derek, Evan. This is Eric.
Oh, Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hi. And I'm one of the who served on the Race Commission, and I want to underscore that, in fact, there is a report out there, over 200 pages, reflecting many months' work and lots of community input on very practical. I'm a little dismayed that the discussants haven't actually looked to the Race Commission or talked about it, because they're very much addressed the kinds of things that could be done and that you've all been talking abstract. There are very specific plans that can be followed. So I'll stop at this point.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Yeah, I absolutely take the point you're making. And what I wanted to ask you, and I'm glad you bring this up, Eric, is that is it possible that the reason government hasn't grabbed on to the Raise Commission report is it possible that the Raise Commission was a sort of cynical placation as opposed to a real open-minded effort on behalf of government at all levels to learn about what needs to change?
I think you could take both points of view. It's very clear that the, Daniel Prude's death made the race commission look very much a, cover-up possibility. Although the commissioners didn't know about it, being one of them, until after we had been sworn in, nor did the chairs know about it. No Bill Johnson, Arlene Santiago, or Dr. Shafiq. Clearly, being on one of the working groups, none of us accepted the idea that this wasn't all the efforts to get community input and community ideas and community participation. Clearly, community members had very strong feelings and many creative ideas across the diverse work groups. To seeing it potentially set aside is, in fact, part of the cynicism that we didn't have. We took it seriously. We were advocates, and there are many practical, actionable things that can be done now. So I really worry that to hear a discussion today where we've got all of this, you know, very critically important data, and I know that Simeon Bannister talked to the commissioners. I know that people at RACF and other organizations know about this, and yet it's not being mentioned or not being thought of or taken seriously is a deep concern and a real, you know, almost like an insult to some of the people who participated, especially from the community.
I'm glad you called, Eric.
I think you know me. I'm very straightforward, so I think I've said enough.
Eric, thank you. Dr. Eric Kane is the former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and yes, worked on the RACE Commission and worked on that report. And Simeon Bannister, we heard Dr. Shafiq, we heard Bill Johnson, among others, on this program after that report came out, imploring the community to grab onto this report, to take it seriously, and then to use it as building blocks. And right now, Eric is saying they already feel sort of forgotten here. How do you see it, Simeon?
Yeah, I hate that they feel forgotten, especially considering that I've read every page of that RACE Commission report. So we would certainly, I would take a divergent opinion about whether it's being taken seriously. And certainly, whether I personally and our organization, the Community Foundation, are taking it seriously, we do take it very seriously. We've enjoyed presentations to our board and staff about the RACE Commission and about its and about many of its recommendations. The challenge is that in a 200-page report with all of the recommendations, many of those recommendations are things that, frankly, we've heard in a lot of different settings over the years. So the question that we have to ask is, why haven't we seen those recommendations come to fruition? I would argue that one of the reasons that there, I would give you two reasons that at least come to my mind. Reason number one is that many of the recommendations have costs attached to them. And oftentimes the resources aren't there. The intentions might be there, but the resources aren't there because of how our system is organized. It would take at least another hour to delve deeply into how our system is organized. But suffice it to say that because of the extractive and exploitative economy that we live in, many of our efforts, despite the fact that they appear on their face to be well-resourced, it's actually kind of like fool's gold, and they actually are not. So that would be number one. The second is that there's a great piece of work, I may have mentioned it on the show before, from an organization, FSG, about how systems change. It's actually called the Waters of Systems Change. And they talk about a number of different levels. So they say that at that first kind of explicit level, you get folks focused on policy and practices, on resource flows, that if we want to be semi-explicit, that we start to talk about power relationships, that we start to talk about who's connected to who. And if we really want to be transformational, they say that that happens when we start to change the mental model, the background noise, the things that people take for granted. I wonder, and there's a role to play, of course, focusing on policies and practices, but the RACE Commission explicitly limited itself to policies and practices, right? Things that could be changed in the law by the county and by the city. And that's an important dimension, but it's not the only dimension. Because the challenge is that if we keep existing with the same mental models, if we keep saying things like the city is bad and the suburbs are good, right? If we keep wrestling with the same approach that says the real answer here is just figuring out how we can suburbanize the city of Rochester, then it seems to me that we've already jumped off the skids. we've got to change that underlying mental model. And in fact, that's what I came to talk to the commission about when I came, as Eric mentioned, and met with them. And it dismays me. I don't know if that message landed fully, that we've got to change the background noise, right? That we've got to have a different appreciation for how and why this community has come to be the way that it is. And we can do that. And I've done this a little bit with my friend Shane Wiegand and others, looking at the actual historical circumstances of our community and then using those historical circumstances to understand where we are. That's the opportunity. If we look historically, we see that resources have been done and have been administered in ways and distributed in ways that are exclusive. This moment, inclusive recovery, making sure that everybody gets a chance to be engaged and participate in the economy, really is a smart way forward.
Let me also just ask about one other point that the Urban Institute and Tina Stacy's team has been working on. And it's a question of targeting not just sort of an inclusive recovery, but targeting what's really been hurt by a pandemic. And even the creation of maps to point out, you know, this is where we've got housing insecurity most acutely in the last year. This is where we have jobs that are just sort of hemorrhaging in this community during this pandemic. Tina Stacy, can you tell me a little bit about the desire to help communities like Rochester sort of visualize exactly where the biggest areas of concern are?
Yeah, so this is a great point. Another way that cities can kind of work towards more of an inclusive and equitable recovery from COVID and just more broadly is to better understand the geographic disparities within a city and within a region where people have been hardest hit. You know, we know that the COVID-19 pandemic has really just exacerbated a lot of inequities that were already existing in our communities. And so we've been working hard to create a bunch of tools that leaders can use to better understand where that's happened. And this, so for instance, you mentioned that we have a housing instability map, so it can show you by neighborhood who is most likely, who is at most risk of being evicted when the eviction moratoriums end, or who is most housing unstable. So this can be used both to help target rent relief programs, but also just outreach assistance for helping people navigate those systems. And, you know, investing and using these tools up front to target resources better to those who need it most can really save money in the long run. And the housing example is a great example, because if we can get housing assistance and rent relief to people before they get to that eviction point, you save money, you don't only just help that one family stay housed and stable, which can help their kids in school and helps with their health, but you help save costs in the court system, in all of the systems that lead up, the homelessness system, if they become homeless later. If you can get ahead of this and invest in resources where they need to be now, then you can help save money down the line and help families in the long run. And so, just to add one,
yeah, please, Tina.
One kind of point to all this. I know, again, I know that these numbers can be dismaying, but if you think about how much harm has been caused by individual policies in our history, and I'll use redlining as an example, right? Redlining and some of the racist housing policies that, you know, started many, many, many years ago have had generational impacts that have led to a lot of the outcomes we've seen. But if you flip that and think about, what if we came up with policies that reversed these inequities, brought us all back in line? Imagine the generational impacts we could have on improving equity and inclusion if we just got this right now. And so during a time of recovery where all of our institutions are already in upheaval anyway, let's upheave them even more and restart and rethink the way that we do everything. So like Simeon said, not just, although it's confusing because I think we do need to hit this from all angles, but, you know, rethinking the whole structure of the way that we do things and the way that we make decisions. And we believe at Urban that using data and evidence to help inform and track and monitor this can really help push this forward.
Simeon, about a minute here. What is going to be in place to hold accountable the decision makers going forward? You have, both publicly and privately to me many times over the years, urge me to make sure that I'm doing my part to hold myself accountable, my organization, my community, the leaders who come on this program or don't, and that is well taken. What's going to happen to make sure that as this money flows through this community, there is accountability that it's being done right? And you might be on mute.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
It certainly was. This week inaugurates a series of steps that we're hoping to engage the community in. As I mentioned at the outset of the show, we have Senator Gillibrand coming at 2 o'clock, so in just a little over an hour from now, recf.org/webinars. And then tomorrow, the ACT Rochester event on inclusive recovery at 9 a.m. is a point of departure for this conversation about how we can leverage these resources. And then in that conversation, we're trying to involve folks that are involved, that are part of the collectives in our community. And so they are engaged at the table as representative of kind of broader constituencies. We know that all of the collectives have really focused lately on community engagement and trying to think about community engagement at scale, right, which is often not done. We know that transparency matters, that accountability matters. And so we're trying to do this in a way that is open and available for the public to not only observe, but to be involved in, to feel the fibers of. And you'll see over the course of the next couple of weeks, opportunities for folks to do that. So we're really excited about some of the infrastructure this community is coming together around to say we need an inclusive recovery. We need to make sure that the resources that are coming here get into the hands of folks that have been excluded. If you want to learn a little bit more, come out today and hear from Senator Gillibrand and hear some of those questions as we hold for some accountability and learning. And then come out tomorrow again as we hold for some accountability and learning at the ACT Rochester event.
Today, 2 o'clock, racf.org/webinars for that. And then tomorrow, ACT Rochester. And what time tomorrow, briefly?
Tomorrow, 9 to 10:15, and you can register at actrochester.org right under the regional map.
And thanks for being with us. Always good to have you.
Happy to be here.
And the Executive Director of ACT Rochester, Simeon Bannister from the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Thank you, Simeon.
Always good to be with you, Evan.
Tina Stacy from the Urban Institute. Thank you, Tina.
Thank you so much.
And more connections coming up.